Thank you, Susan. Somebody in the back, raise your hand if I don't get the sound right. So, okay. Wonderful day, beginning with the wonderful presentation Julie gave us this morning and coming up to the last end. So I'm not at a loss of what to say, but I am in awe of what we've heard so far. If I go on too long, you'll see I'm not at a loss for words. Let me begin. Being the final speaker here, what I've absorbed, of course, I'm going to throw away the conversation and the talk that I was going to give you and redo it, as is my wont. But the place I find myself wanting to talk about is the very first book I wrote, which was PhD thesis, basically, was on the bombing of Hiroshima. Odd place to start. And the puzzlement was why this country and its leaders, knowing there were alternatives, which is now established, nevertheless went forth with those bombings. What was the nature of our culture and the expansion that had created it and the system that had driven it that ended up doing that and doing Vietnam and Korea and Iraq and Afghanistan and the World Bank, and the IMF, what was that all about? I'm giving you shorthand for a way of thinking about very complex ideas that people, I'm sure, understand. But the short circuit is some form of odd kind of American imperialism, and it was better than colonialism, came out of this particular system. And it was a tragic and ironic form because there's a genuine interest in promoting democracy and liberty, and there's a genuine interest in running the global economy in a way that people thought and do think is the only way possible. I've worked at high levels of the US government and the Senate. People believe they are doing well. It is not that these are bad folks. And yet, havoc is wreaked. Wars go on. The third world is badly destroyed. We are up against not simply a power structure, not simply a system called capitalism, but a way of thinking that is genuine and honorable, and in my view, wrong. So it is better to start there, I think, when we think about what's going on, than in demonizing. But it's a big deal, because now you're up against something more powerful. You're up against a system, whatever that might mean, and a culture and an ideology. So that's kind of driven me back into the kinds of questions that I think are being posed by the Occupy Wall Street and by many of the people who have spoken so far today. You can put it another way. If you don't like corporate capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what the hell do you want and why should we listen to if you don't know? Seriously, what do you want? What do we want? And if we don't know, what are you talking about? So, I don't pretend to offer you a final answer to that, but I do think that question is on the table. It's on the table for the first time in my adult lifetime. It may be on the table for the first time in American history. We can go through the long history of how, in the 19th century, free land allowed for almost anything when the problems occurred. And how in the 20th century, not by design, wars in the first quarter of the century, in the second quarter of the century, both bailed out great stagnation and then Great Depression, Korea, Vietnam, and the high military budgets of the third quarter of the century. Those were not by design, but they stabilized the system. With nuclear weapons, I think we are up against the incapacity of that particular mechanism to stabilize this particular system. I don't think it will collapse. The US government was an 11% floor in 1929. It is now roughly a 30% floor, depending upon what the GDP denominator is. It may stagnate and decay and stagnate and decay and stagnate and decay, all the while gobbling resources and creating climate destruction. That's an odd context. I think that's the context we are moving into historically. It is also a context that is steadily forcing people to ask deeper and deeper and deeper questions, triggered by what we've seen happen wonderfully with Occupy Wall Street. It would not have triggered such a reaction if people didn't know something was wrong. People sense there is something profoundly wrong. Many don't have words for it, certainly don't have concrete actions in many cases, have some inkling of what needs to be done. There's a lot of projects, there are a lot of ideas. But when a large number of people realize, including the Tea Party in its strange way, that something's wrong with this, that's a very profound moment of history. It is the most profound moment of history I have ever engaged. And I lived through the 60s, was very active in the anti-war movement and in the civil rights movement and so forth. Those movements, particularly the feminist movement and the civil rights movement, were about getting into the system, largely. Let us in. Don't discriminate. Don't discriminate. Don't discriminate. There were pieces of those movements that had a different vision. That was the dominant form. And the environmental movement was regulate the corporations. And indeed, there was a moment burst open to try to regulate. I think that moment is over, and getting in is no longer the question, except for very large numbers of people, particularly minorities, who are not getting in at all. Those are no longer the primary questions. There are profound questions of how the system works and whether it can be changed en large, I think. So I think that's what the underlying problem we're talking about here is. If you don't like capitalism and you don't like socialism, what the hell do you want and how do you get there? So that's where I'm coming from, just to lay my cards on the table. Another way to come at it is we spend a great deal of time at the Democracy Collaborative not theorizing and errorizing about history, though that's where we're coming from, Ted Howard and I, who's someone who will talk about the Cleveland Project in a few minutes, but asking, is there anything that people are actually doing on the ground which a totally financially constrained press doesn't have the money or the interest in covering that's actually going on the ground? So here's a web page for you, community-wealth, www.org. Put the dash in. What we do is try to find out what's out there. And we've been doing it for longer than I care to remember. But there are, in one form or another, 4,000 or 5,000 neighborhood corporations, nonprofit corporations trying to benefit communities, some good, some bad, some very interesting, some not so interesting. There are, if you include all forms of worker-owned co-ops, and they come in various flavors, and some not so good, some wonderful, some changing before, even ESOPs are changing, by the way. Many are becoming unionized and participatory. There are something like 11,000 of those involving 5 or 6 more million people than are involved in the labor movement. On the ground in America today, nobody's covering it. It's not being talked about. Land trusts, which Bob Swan started, 30 years ago, there were none. They are now popping up in different forms, hundreds of them around the country. All over the country, people are looking at various forms of ownership. The land trust is another. There are co-ops, including the credit unions. I opened the morning news this morning, and the credit unions were becoming very popular as a place to shift your money, all of a sudden. There are 120 million Americans involved in one or another form of co-ops, including, of course, credit unions. So there are, I can go on and give you more and more of these examples. You find them on the website. There are nonprofit corporations called social enterprises. The sole purpose of the business is to do some good mission for society. They're popping up all over. Municipal ownership is beginning. People are not aware. There's municipal ownership for hotels, of land development, rivers. There are 500 projects around the country where cities have established ownership of capturing the gas off of the garbage and turning it into electricity and turning it into jobs and turning it into revenues. So it's another form. And by the way, for you socialists out there, you probably are aware that 25% of America's electricity is created and distributed by either public utilities or co-ops. 25%. Public enterprise. Efficient. Much cheaper because the executive salaries are not high and there's no profits. On balance, as efficient or more efficient and more ecologically developed and amenable to community interest. So there's a lot of, I could go on this way, there are a lot of very interesting things going on. States are invest, some states, there are 27 states that currently, these are state governments, public ownership, owning and establishing businesses, venture capitalist firms in which the state keeps an ownership part. America? Socialism? There are very, very many character projects like this that I'm just giving you the kind of surface level of that are just not reported on. Many of them are really interesting from an ecological point of view. Many of them are not. But there is a lot of accumulating experience, one part of which, and I'm picking and choosing on these, they all democratize the ownership of capital. What did I say? I said they democratize the ownership of capital in a very down-home American way. Co-ops, land trusts, municipal enterprise, a lot of them in the South, by the way. And they begin to tell you something about the possibility, no more yet, no more yet, of slowly establishing in a radically decentralized, localist, and then maybe further way, a different vision of how wealth, productive wealth, might actually be organized, maybe even some principles which would allow you to begin talking about a long-term systemic possibility. Maybe. Systems are characterized historically and currently, above all, by who owns the capital. Property relationships, feudalism, capitalism, state socialism. And if you don't like any of those, ultimately, you've got to ask who owns the capital in your system. We now know that 1% owns just under 1%, just under 50% of the investment capital in this system. 5% own 70%. It is an extremely highly concentrated corporate capitalist system, maybe even more extreme in its ownership patterns than medieval society. I say that not rhetorically. The pattern is medieval in its scale and scope of concentration of ownership. So ultimately, if you are interested in systemic change, now I'm going to use a loaded word, rather than projectism, we must address who owns capital and what does the system look like that might be democratized, that might be very American in content, and that might give rise to the principles and nurture principles of democracy, ownership, and community, and ecological sustainability. I was legislative director to Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day. Our goal then was to regulate. We've run out of that possibility, I believe. There are deeper pressures at work. So let me say just a bit of a word about that and sharpen the edge of this nasty argument I'm making. In all of the advanced systems, including some that were discussed this morning, particularly those little countries in Europe, like Germany, I'm going to come back to that, but remember, Germany in scale can be tucked into Montana. We live in a continent. If you want democracy in a continent, you've got a big problem because those countries are little. I sometimes say to my students, just to drive the nail in, like those dinky little countries, France and Germany, meaning that the polity is organizable in smaller scale than in a continent, maybe. But what has happened, I think you can see in this country, in all of the places where you actually had the kind of advances towards using the regulatory system, the regulatory state, to manage environmental issues, sort of, you also had strong labor movements. Historically, the progressive parties required a strong labor movement, even when it had fights with the environmental movement, to enthrone a regime that could manage through the regulatory system problems of the environment. One of the positives and one of the negatives we face is that the American labor movement is in radical decay, under attack, and is faltering and becoming worse and worse. It was at its height a very weak labor movement. The Swedes were at 80% of the labor force. At the height, we were at 34.5% of the labor force organized. That was 1946. The total labor movement's 11%, 11.8%, 11.9%, depends whose numbers are used, 5% in the private sector and declining. I push that number out and underline it for a reason. Some people believe that there will be a resurgent of the old Democratic Liberal Party, out of which I grew. I'm a Wisconsin progressive, through the organization of power to make the state powerful enough to manage the corporate problems that can be identified and spoken about as were discussed today. Social democracy abroad, progressive liberalism here. My contention is that option is over, or it is in decay. I'll take as much of it as I can get, but it is not the future. And it, underlying that reality, if it is a reality, so I give it to you to chew on and fight with and struggle with, means there either is another way forward or there is not a way forward. That's what we used to call in the 60s a heavy rap. If the traditional models of managing the problems we address, from inequities, social problems, environmental, required a strong social democratic formation of the labor movement at its core. And if that's over, either there is another way forward, institutionally, not just good folks, the institutional muscle and organizing power and money of an institution, in this case labor, or there's no way forward. We can struggle about that. My suggestion to you is, paradoxically, precisely because of the failure of this particular way of going about business, out of which I come, paradoxically, we're finding these things developing around the country, and we're finding anger, we're finding consciousness change, and sense that something's wrong, and why so many people have responded to Occupy Wall Street. My hat's off to Occupy Wall Street. What is important is that there's a huge response that tells you about America. There is something brewing, and I believe that the paradox is that almost because of the failings of this way of going about managing corporate capitalism, we are beginning to think about and build institutions and develop ideas and develop consciousness that's beginning to point in a different direction. Maybe. I'm enough of an old Schumacher, and by the way, you know Schumacher was a socialist. Did you know that? Everyone failed, likes the first three parts of Small is Beautiful. Read the fourth part. Schumacher argued, and we honor this and need to face it. I'm going to give you the quote. Private ownership of large-scale industry is an absurdity. Small is beautiful. And he struggled with, what do you do about that? He came up with two or three. Nationalization was one. Remember, he was chief economist of the National Coal Board. Nationalized industry, which, by the way, was as efficient as our coal, more efficient than our coal industry. He struggled with, what do you do about that? Do you want to set up? Scott Bader was one of his options. Then he had complex schemes to transfer ownership in a different way to the communities, or maybe nationalization, or maybe nonprofits. We haven't even stepped up to that question. We've been looking at local projects, and they're kind of giving us ideas about, you might even be able, the last speaker, you might even be able to organize a local economy around small, high-tech businesses, the kind Julie was talking about, different co-ops, land trusts, all sorts of nonprofits, social enterprise. You might even be able to begin to do that, but what do you do about big enterprise? And then there's another dirty word. And what do you do about planning? You want to manage a slow growth, low growth economy? You are ultimately talking, whether you're talking about how hours may be changed and the policies involved, the things that Julie was talking about, or talking about changing material input, you are talking about regimes using one or another mechanism, regulation, tax benefits, or other forms that are inherently a planning system. Now you're back to power. By the way, we plan all the time. That's what's going on with the committees in Congress right now. They're going to give you a very nasty plan, but it will be an integrated plan that's going to cut your budgets and cause more recession and so forth. We do planning. The question is who controls the planners. So if you're interested in systemic change, not just projectism, we're going to have to face not only those kinds of questions, but the kinds of institutions from the ground up that begin to establish the power base over time, over the long haul, that might set the terms of reference for the larger patterns we're talking about. My term for that is a pluralist commonwealth. Many different forms, co-ops, land trusts, worker-owned companies, etc., plural forms of commonwealth. I don't think it's a great term, but it's descriptive of the mix and the kind of American diversity that my friends in Racine, Wisconsin, where I come from, would understand. I can talk to my conservative friends about that from high school. They understand you can do these things in Racine, Wisconsin, and you better be able to understand it or you're not going to get anywhere. I have found when we talk about real things on the ground, almost anybody can be these discussions can be had with. And then they begin to lead to larger questions. I have a very, very conservative friend from my old high school buddy, very, very brilliant, very right-wing guy, very religious. And I go back to him in Wisconsin, I said, well, what do you think of Russ Feingold when he was still running? He said, well, you know, I voted for Russ. You voted for Russ Feingold? He was a man of principle. He said what he meant, and I respect that. Strange, strange quality. So one of the lessons is, what do you want, and can you say it with integrity and meaning, and also know what you're talking about, really? So let me press forward a little bit on some of the elements that take us beyond projectism and begin to offer maybe a sketch of what could become maybe a systemic design. Maybe. One of the speakers talked about a project we've been heavily involved with in Cleveland, Ohio, the Evergreen Cooperatives, the Democracy Collaborative, did a great deal of work on that. And it was work that came, we tried to do it elsewhere, at the University of Maryland, but we ran into trouble, which that similar project. But finally, for odd reasons, and by the way, odd reasons are important. Things happen. Take advantage of them. We've helped launch this project with the help of many, many, many other people in Ohio. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about the project, but also about the process that built it and where it's going, but also about what it suggests about design. Many of you know, these are worker co-ops. They are in a neighborhood we haven't talked about. Julie mentioned that many, many of the people who have been involved in the new economy movement are highly educated, wealthy, mostly white, not entirely. This project is in a part of Cleveland, Ohio, where the median income is $18,000 per family, almost entirely black. And in that community, for complex reasons, and a long history about which I will say only a little bit, we can talk more about it later, there is now developing a complex of worker-owned companies that are sophisticated in design and also a little bit different from just co-ops. I'm going to underline that because those of you who know something about what's co-ops and worker-owned co-ops, they have a dicey history because you run into a lot of problems without an adequate capital source, without an adequate market. There's history. The ejido in Mexico was brutally destroyed, which is a peasant cooperative structures built into Mexico. If you look closely at, someone else mentioned Argentine worker-owned companies, very exciting. But if you actually study, the ones that are now succeeding, for the most part, not entirely, are also linked to the municipal purchasing power of Buenos Aires municipal government, slightly stabilizing part of the market. What's going on in Cleveland is, we'll talk about Mondragon. It draws on Mondragon. Some of you know about Mondragon, I'm sure many do, in some partial ways. But the Cleveland model is as follows. There are a series of worker-owned cooperatives. There's a large, the most ecologically kind of advanced laundry in the north part of Ohio. It uses about a third of the water and heats about a third of the water. There's a solar installation company. There, we just broke ground on a 3.5-acre greenhouse. There are about two businesses a year that are going to be set up. There's a revolving fund that helps finance these. And it is a complex, significantly oriented by design at the purchasing power of large not-for-profit institutions in the area. Hospitals and universities, primarily. In that particular part of Cleveland, the universities and hospitals purchase $3 billion a year. I was excited to hear someone talking earlier about what could be done with university endowments. $3 billion a year in that neighborhood, plus construction, plus salaries. That's just procurement. All nonprofit. Mostly subsidized by the taxpayer, either through Medicare or Medicaid in the hospital system or the university system, educational money, and none of it going there. So what has happened here is, by a very complex organizing process, some part of that procurement, very small part, is being directed to partly stabilize, not entirely, we use the free market as well, the cooperatives in a way that gives them some stability and some protection from the violence of the free market. And the reason is not simply that people like worker co-ops, and not simply because some of these nonprofits have an interest in improving the neighborhood. Hospitals like to have it a little bit better around their environs, but they are helping rebuild the community as a whole, not just a few workers. That's a sin in some quarters. There are purists who don't want to hear me say that. The nonprofits, the worker-owned companies in the Cleveland are by design linked to a nonprofit community benefiting corporation. They are run independently. They give back 10% of the profits to a revolving fund, and some part of which is used for the community, but otherwise they are independent worker-owned companies, except they can't be sold. And the principle is we are building community, not simply a couple of workers who will run off to the suburbs as soon as they make some money and sell the company. That, by the way, purists in the co-op movement, there are about 300 to 400, maybe 500, genuine worker co-ops that have not increased in scale or size for many, many years. But they hold the principle of worker ownership rather than community as sacrosanct. And the argument here is that, no, there is a larger interest, particularly if we are using community benefiting institutions, health and education, and the reconstruction of the community as a whole as a goal, there is a larger interest in building a structure that is responsive to that. So that's a little bit, we have to chew on that. That's an oddity. And that's a principle. And we're trying to stabilize the market substantially because there are so many community interests involved. It will be very easy otherwise for a very large multinational that's doing solar installations to zoom in on these small companies, undercut the prices for a year or two, and clobber them. In Buenos Aires, they use the city government for exactly the same purposes to help stabilize, in part, the market of these companies. I have just given you a design principle for a radically decentralized, if you expand the principle, for a radically decentralized, community-building, cooperative system. Were you to apply that principle, substantial stability of community markets, a community-sustaining system, in which worker ownership was linked in a design of that kind, and built that simple principle, you would have the design of something that doesn't look like corporate capitalism and doesn't look like state socialism and begins with the principle of community as the dominant principle and works backward from there. I think that's an important question, and let me tell you why. If you don't do that, not only do you uproot the communities, something like that. Cleveland was a city of 800,000. It's now 300,000. Where did the people go? They were blown away, scattered. Nobody cares, particularly for the black and poor. Either you can stabilize that community, boom, or that's what happens as capital moves on. Secondly, we have been throwing away, literally throwing away cities. If you have an interest in carbon content, interest in rebuilding cities, and then rebuilding them again when we do that. Extraordinary capital costs, extraordinary carbon costs. Third principle, if you don't substantially stabilize the local basis of the economy, you cannot do serious planning for sustainability, high density, mass transportation planning, the key ingredients to changing the carbon footprint of a community. And if it moves on in fragments, you can't do climate change there. There won't be anybody there enough to do it. You'll have wreckage as they move on to the next and the next. Think about that. Simple question. If you want to stabilize communities, you're going to have to do something about it. And I just said planning. That is to say, we've written about this in some other ways, but supposing we were to have a serious mass transit high-speed rail system, just supposing we were able to step up to what is obvious in many other countries, and what we will one day do when we overcome, then we would have a lot of things to build as a society. And they would all be paid for by taxpayers and commuters. Would we want to hand it over to Bombardier, Canadian company, or the Spanish companies, or the German companies, all vying for this? Or could we not begin rebuilding American transit and manufacturing and target the jobs to stabilize communities so that the communities might be stabilized as well in a way that dealt with the underlying problems in communities that lead to climate change? Again, I've taken that little tiny model in Cleveland and extended it over time to some of the ingredients of a larger systemic model to try to deal with some of these problems and do it in a decentralized way. Now, I've been around a long time, as Susan said. I do not think we're going to do this tomorrow. But I'm also a historian. I wear these two hats, political economist and historian. You know, systemic change comes and goes. Most societies endure radical changes, unexpected. Social movements arise out of nowhere. I wrote a book published a couple of years ago, America Beyond Capitalism. I was glad I said, there's going to be a movement that's going to explode. It's the first time I've actually predicted something in general, very general, because there's something wrong. And people know something larger must be done. We are now casting about, looking, and doing wonderful experiments, and trying to learn, and trying to begin to sense where to go. Opened up now, for the first time in many generations, to really rethinking things. Now, we're talking about systemic change. You want to play this game? The chips are decades of your life. Don't mess with it unless you're willing to really dig in and, you know, put some time on the line. decades of your life. By the way, I'm talking to the person in your chair. This is not a general discussion. These are existential questions as much as they are systemic questions about whether we want to do something or not. So what becomes necessary is not opening up, as we have seen from Occupy Wall Street, but not only doing projects and learning about the multitude of projects out there that are the kind of things at this stage of development, in my view, that begin to give people an inkling of what might be. They're not a lot more than that, but that's a hell of a lot. And they begin to give people a chance to theorize and begin to develop what might happen if we extended these principles. And what might happen if we began to add up piece by piece other parts of the political and social and cultural movements who care about community, democracy, equality, even liberty is at stake. Liberty's at stake because if this thing decays much more, we're going to see violence, and then there'll be a crackdown. So heavy-duty issues are on the table. In any case, right now, there's a lot to do. It's a moment really opening up, and it's an exciting moment to begin to do all of this and to step up to it in a way that takes us beyond anything that was done in the 60s, and I think in the 30s, and in the progressive era before that. That is to say, the slow and steady reconstruction culturally of the notion of a community as Americans, culturally as a community in Cleveland, Ohio, or Racine, Wisconsin. The re-knitting of community as a cultural as much as an economic idea, and doing it in a way that is informed by what we've learned from the ecological and the environmental movement, but is also very tough-minded about systemic questions. I don't want to see American co-ops go the way of the Ejido or the many other co-ops that have died aborning. I'm not interested in token jobs that fall apart. The question, if I'm, you know, even roughly close to the ball, the question is systemic, not projectism. Let me see if I can say that another way. We need projects desperately, and we need to advance and learn from them and develop them. But we need to go beyond projectism to systemic change and a vision that is real and can answer the questions. If you don't like capitalism, you don't like socialism, what do you want, and how are you going to get there? Really? And if you don't have an answer, why should we listen to you? A starting point is where we are, but I think we need collectively to grapple with that in a much more sophisticated way than any of us has ever stepped up to, and then begin to advance it and look out for it in cultural ways, political ways, economic ways, and beyond. What is really interesting is that the ingredients are here. The cultural ingredients and what young people have shown us, the beginnings of awareness that something is truly profoundly wrong, the global aspects of this that are beginning to say something is globally wrong, the economic experiments reaching a stage we can actually learn from them and develop them, and the economics of it beginning to develop. All of this, I think, is on our plate, and in an exciting way. It does have the problem, though. If what I've said is even halfway true, it does present this very, very nasty existential problem. If even maybe it is our lot in history to open the possibility of that future, really, we have some responsibility in the matter. Talking to the person in your seat and mine. So I'm in a church. I always wanted to be a rabbi. The questions really, as I say, I think come down to, can we as a whole learn enough, do enough, and rise to the occasion to be able actually to transform the most powerful corporate capitalist system in the history of the world? I think maybe we can. just possibly, and in any case, it's certainly worth a hell of a try because it's all positive development anyway. So thank you very much. Thank you. Susan said I should just take some questions.
So we'll start with this one. How does the advent of the information age change what you think is possible in the realm of social organization and deep systemic change? So it's about the advent of the information age.
Well, we all know the answer to that. I mean, it's unbelievable possibilities come with it if we can utilize them. That's a no-brainer. That's an information age question, of course. I mean, the possibilities that of communication that are opened up are spectacular. You can all find out about all of these things that you couldn't find out when the press doesn't cover them. Now you can find information like that. Fantastic. That's it. Yeah. an easy one.
This one here starts with thank you. Your comments focusing on community were inspiring. In what ways is there a positive role for centralized government in your vision?
Well, I am saying, my anarchist friends, I am saying that if you don't deal with the state will deal with you. And I am for as radical a decentralization as we can find, and we need to deal with state power in an intelligent way. So that's a challenge. We can debate that and discuss it. And that means politics. And I agree with Julie, the question of the state comes up in the vision that she was laying out. You cannot do many things without the state. So let me give you some hope in this very large, about politics. I just did a piece that's been floating around the web. It was done for Dissent, but it's been bouncing around the web. And I've been looking at the substructure, you know, something that you don't find covered in the New York Times, or the Wall Street Journal, or the Washington Post, certainly, of state by state by state by state. So the state, as in Massachusetts, in many parts of the country, there are 20 states that are now considering single-payer legislation, healthcare. Now, that's a fight for the next, it'll cost about a decade to get that. You don't play without throwing a decade of your life on the table. There are 14 that are considering publicly owned banks like the Bank of North Dakota. There are 27 that are doing public investing, and many, many are using, including Alabama, by the way, because it's a maverick, state public pension funds investing in worker-owned companies. Alabama, weird. So if you look around at the states, state by state by state, despite the Republican conservative takeover, there are lots of interesting things that can be done in different states. California just did something really interesting on climate change. So I think in one sense, one possible way forward, there are many possible routes, is the development state by state, as in the pre-New Deal era, in which state laboratories developed things that became the basis when the moment came for national policy. There are many things to do in cities and states to support this kind of a vision. So I would think that's a place to begin looking in terms of state power. Now let me throw one ringer at you. This is, in my experience, there's two things that really drive my students crazy when I say them, but I'll have to throw them at you because I think they're true. You can measure whether they're true. The United States is a country of 316 million now, pointing towards probably 500 million by 2060. And if you take the high estimate of the Census Bureau, it will be over a billion by the end of the century. Now, hopefully we're not going to do that high estimate, but the numbers get very large no matter what you say. Those of you who believe in participatory democracy, can you have any form of meaningful participatory democracy in a continent of 500 or 600 million people? And the answer is probably no. And if most of the states are too small for economic management, and a continent's too large for democracy, it's already stalemated in this archaic system, political system, the intermediate unit is called a region. There was a huge debate amongst liberals, conservatives, and radicals in the 1930s about how you begin to regionalize, not decentralize, the economic system. And I think that's inevitable under almost any regime. People don't like to think about regionalizing. It's a hard one. But some of the most interesting work on this was done by thoughtful conservatives, by the way, as well as thoughtful radicals and liberals. So I think that's on our agenda. The other thing students really don't want to hear about, so I'll throw it at you, is the technology permits radical reduction, as Julie's taught us, of time. Time committed to work that you have to do really does permit radical reductions. Really? 10-hour week? 15-hour week? A necessitous time? Yeah? They're scared of that. They really don't like that. What'll I do with my life? Wonderful things to do. But the two big issues that are implicit at a personal level are scale and time. And thanks to Julie, we've begun to work on the first one. We've got a lot more work to do on the second one, the scale issue, I think. So enough on where governance goes at some point. I guess I have to say that now. If I say enough on that, don't trust me. Let me say one other thing. How many know about Mondragon? Mondragon's very hot right now. Mondragon is this series of about 85,000 people involved in about 80 different co-ops now. It moves up and down in the Basque country of Spain. Extraordinarily interesting model, and has become very hot in terms of discussing what might be done. We drew on Mondragon in Cleveland in the terms of a revolving fund and some of the worker participation processes, et cetera. So I'm going to give you a little challenge about Mondragon. Not because I'm interested in challenging Mondragon, because I'm interested in raising the problem that we face. You're going to hear a lot more about Mondragon in the next months, because they are over here. They just cut some kind of a deal with the steelworkers, and they're trying to come into the U.S. market with Mondragon. And it is very exciting, because it's one of the most advanced models. But the reason they're here is they need markets. They are up against the world market, world capitalist market, and the Chinese and the Eastern Europeans are driving up against them. They are not trying to transform the system. They are trying to help the people in the Basque Country by building a worker-owned model in the world market. And I ask you, when you read about Mondragon, to consider the questions that are posed for a planning or stabilizing system when you look at the market problem. So Mondragon really raises that, and it's very exciting in many dimensions, but it poses the question of stability or running up against the power of the market.
Which means
the state is involved with state planning of some form.
This question was actually on the Mondragon, but just to follow up on it, how does it compare with the Ohio co-op that you talked about?
Well, that's perfect timing. The Ohio co-op is a community-wide model with worker-owned companies connected to a community-building nonprofit corporation oriented significantly to a system that can provide some stability of the market, in this case, nonprofit hospitals and universities. Could be the government doing mass transit. But that's the model. And the revolving fund was drawn directly from Mondragon. We actually took many, many people out to see Mondragon because they thought a co-op was one of those little dinky things around the corner. And they saw this incredible, it's almost like a Fortune 500 company. So those are the distinctions. Mondragon is playing in the market, and there have been some real problems if you read the critical literature. But more important than the critical problems, they are up against the market. And they're trying to operate in a market rather than trying to work with a planning system. So I'll just toss that out for you to chew on, because if we're interested in systemic change, I think you've got to play with that question, really.
So these are interrelated questions about projects, moving from projects to system. Can you talk about more specifics about how to move from projects to systems? Which organizations do you believe are offering opportunities for systemic change? As difficult as it seems, how can projects like the Evergreen Co-ops be replicated elsewhere?
Those are wonderful. Let me tell you, first, there's a lot of interest in Evergreen, far too much in the Cleveland co-ops. And the reason is far too much, because there are going to be problems. These are startups, and they're going to stumble and fall. But nonetheless, there's excitement. And there are many, many, many cities that now want to do Mondragon, including one interesting one in Texas, which I, at another day, will tell you about. Pittsburgh, Washington, D.C. area, Atlanta, the ones that are hot right now, Oakland, California, one in Texas. But there's a real hunger. And really strikingly to me, I was talking about my friend Tony in Racine, Wisconsin, who I grew up with, very conservative. This is my experience. If you actually know what it is you're talking about in detail, like the Cleveland things, my friend is very conservative. We're finding that people who, not national ideologues whose businesses and careers are made on pumping ideology into the air, but people who think they're moderates or conservatives, are very, very open to practical ideas of this kind. So I had an experience in, wonderful experience. One morning I was talking to the Chamber of Commerce in one of the surrounding cities of Washington, D.C., one of the wealthy suburbs. And they thought this was one, Cleveland model was spectacular. And the president of the hospital was there. He said, I've got 60% of the hospital market, I'm on. That night I was talking to radical organizers in Baltimore. Same response. What it comes from is making real concrete sense. And if you can do that, and if it really does make sense, lots of Americans can hear, because there's a lot of problems out there, and ideology drops very different at the local level, very different. The problem often, so let me put this rabbi thing, the problem is often us. We don't engage, and we haven't really done our homework. But my experience is there are many people who are so-called conservatives who are deeply moral and caring people who care about their community and care about a lot of folks there, and they haven't been offered this kind of thing to think about. And when you do, it's really quite remarkable. But I guess one more thing. As I told you, don't trust me. But I want to tell you about how the Cleveland model really came about. And this goes back to those decades on the table business. I was involved years ago in a big fight in Youngstown, Ohio over a major steel company. Some of the gray hairs might remember the Youngstown shut. It was the first big closing in the steel industry, got national publicity all the time. And the religious coalition got together, a worker suggested, why don't we take it over? It became a big fight for worker ownership, and the national religious organizations took it over, and it got a lot of press and so forth. They even forced the Carter administration into promising $200 million in loan guarantees. This is Ohio. After the election, two things happened. The Carter administration pulled back the money. But the religious coalition and the steelworkers knew that was possible, and they understood that their job was to educate as well as to try to do this. So they knew what they were doing. They were projecting an idea as well as trying to do a project. So it got lost. Not only that, you ask, this is about how you get there. The U.S. steelworkers in those days, really interesting. The international union destroyed the local union that wanted the worker ownership. Why? Because these guys were activists and they were going to challenge the leadership in Pittsburgh and internationally. They didn't want activists. Kill them, get rid of their jobs, they'll go away. That's what they did. Two things have happened. The U.S. steelworkers are now for worker ownership. It took them 30 years. They are the leading voice in the steel industry. They've evolved. Interesting. Put some decades on the table. And some of the, in the state of Ohio, there are more worker-owned companies per capita, I'm told, I don't know if the number is right, but it's probably close, than any place else in the country, out of that fight. So even a losing fight created an idea whose time is coming in Cleveland, and some of the people who did it were inspired by Youngstown. The late John Loeb, who set up a worker-owned company out of Kent State University, died recently, was one of the instrumental people we worked with in Cleveland. So some of these battles, even though they look like losses, if you really go forward, the process of a change may come, and now Cleveland's happening in different parts of the country. We'll see how far it goes.
I think the next question is, why do we need systemic change at all? Why would we need systemic change as such? if local community co-ops of all different sorts answer the issues at hand. It sounds a bit like an academic wish instead of a practical matter.
I've been trying to say why, if you simply set up co-ops, which I'm for, remember I'm from Wisconsin, the place is filled with co-ops, they are likely either to be marginalized, as they are in most parts of the country, even though we've got lots of them, or be destroyed by the market. So if you want to deal with the forces that are destroying these entities that are important to community rebuilding, you must deal with larger forces. I call them planning forces. They have capital, they have markets, they're pieces of the puzzle to give stability to it. So the answer is, if you don't deal with the system's going to deal with you.
The next question, it's more of a comment. The issue for me is, how do we best promote the well-being of working people? Blue collar, white collar, and unemployed. One part of this is to redistribute responsibility amongst government, business, non-profits, neighborhoods, families, churches, and individuals themselves. Your proposal might address this issue as well.
Yeah, the goal of us, it's what we're talking about is, I was talking about the mass transit, building mass transit, which is typically a blue-collar industry of steel and auto, it might be transformed into that. Yeah, the goal is a movement that is inclusive, that begins to have a different content, and that builds, that is not to say to abandon what can be done through traditional social and liberal programs, I don't think. We need whatever we can get. But to begin to build movement that has a different content that can actually deal with these institutional questions, both of power, the institutional power base of these kinds of institutions, and deal with the realities of market problems that are generating the forces that are destroying the environment, that are destroying communities, that are destroying people's lives. So it's a double-barreled goal. I think that's the only way you can talk about the folks in Wisconsin that I come from, that is the working people who just had this big fight. Let me dramatize that for you. I'm from Wisconsin. I worked heavily in Wisconsin progressive politics, progressive movement, the environmental movement. Wonderful battle in Wisconsin and energized the nation. It was a weakening, going backwards, defensive battle that lost ground. The contract that was signed was a contract far worse than it ever had in the bargaining procedures. So they stopped the worst, but it is a resistance movement, not a progressive movement. We need to underline that, because a lot that we're doing in the environmental movement so far is a resistance movement trying to resist worsening trends going backwards, not advancing the ball. And when we're talking about these issues, the question is, can you do with the systemic problems that allow you to advance the ball rather than slow down the decay? That's also true on the distribution of income. The minimum wage is lower than it was in real terms in Kennedy's era, but it's better had there not been something. We're a resistance movement. The worsening problems. So either there's a new way forward, I think I'm getting to the end of my comments, either we over the next decade build a new way forward, or I think the decay continues. And what is exciting, I think, about what folks have done at Occupy Wall Street is they've awakened us to the need to do something new and open that door. Whether we can walk through it intelligently and with fervor and private and intelligence, that's our problem. So thank you very much.